Welcome to the Speed Trap Podcast. I'm Betsy.
And I'm Sophie. Join us weekly to stay updated on the latest racing news.
And to hear our thoughts and opinions on each topic.
And today on Reverse Gear, we talk about Team Histories Part 2. If you missed Part 1 of Team Histories, you can head back and find that on any of your favorite listening platforms. And the teams we did cover and talk about in that episode were Ferrari, Alfa Romeo, Aston Martin, McLaren, and Williams. So in this episode, we're going to be talking about the remainder of the field, including Mercedes, Alpine, Red Bull, AlphaTauri, and Haas. So let's jump in, and we can start with Mercedes. Okay, so Mercedes, of course, ever complicated, because it did enter later. Mm-hmm. First of all, has been around motorsport since the very beginning. Not in Formula One, though. It's not where they started. They started in Le Mans, actually. Mm-hmm. And were doing pretty well. And then there was a horrible crash, and it wasn't a Mercedes driver. But it was a horrible crash in Le Mans, just outside the pit lane. And it killed a bunch of people, including a driver, and including around 120 spectators.
Yeah.
Awful.
Like, really terrible. Like, scary, scary stuff. I was reading about it, and I was like,
yes.
God.
Very famous incident in motorsport history.
Yeah.
So, at that time, Mercedes took an overnight vote. And they said, nah, we're leaving. I don't want any part of this. And so they left until they decided to buy. I'll explain the buyouts quickly. But they re-entered Formula One in the 2000s, basically. So... Wild time for them.
Huge gap.
Really. Like a huge gap. Like it's really, no, truly. So anyways, very foundation of Mercedes before Mercedes wanted anything else to do with motorsport was the Tyrrell Racing Organization.
Tyrrell.
It's fine.
You're just Americanizing it. It's okay. We know what
Tyrrell.
You mean.
Okay.
We know what you mean.
Okay. And... It was founded and first started racing back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it wasn't anything, like, to write home about. It was not a huge part of, you know, the sports. Nothing crazy. Mm. But they were relatively decent. They did only end up with 23 race victories, which wasn't ideal for anyone. But they did win a Constructors' Championship in 1971 and two Drivers' Championships in 1971 and 1973, which was pretty good. And so eventually in 1998, fun.
Shout out to us. 1998.
Shout out to us. So eventually they're bought out and they became... British American Racing.
Bar. Yeah.
Which originally was called, and this is kind of funny in my opinion, British American Tobacco.
Right.
But because those regulations changed, they had to change it to something that did not mention tobacco.
Yes. Which and then, also, if they didn't change those regulations, what a horrible name for a Formula One team.
Right? That's really funny, though. Eventually, though, Honda Racing F1 bought it. And here we have Honda, again, in the mix, just randomly.
They've always been in the mix, huh? Just everywhere.
They really have. Just kind of, like, low-key.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty funny.
Which, good for them, also, for coming into this very European-based sport. Well, very European-based at the time sport to come in as an Asian team and really dominate the engine market.
Yeah. So they originally provided the engines for the British American Racing / tobacco. But then they officially bought out the team and rebranded it as Honda. As actual Honda. And then in 2008, none other than Ross Braun decided to purchase it. And
well, because Honda decided to pull out of the sport entirely, right?
Right. So Honda again was like, "Nah, I don't want to do this."
And it was like a shock move because it was a response to, was it Fukushima? I think there was a tsunami. Or an earthquake, and it was the nuclear disaster, right? And so, in order to save face, as they say, they pulled out, very similar to how they're pulling out from, or pulled out from preventing Red Bull with engines now, because it was for Japan were facing financial woes because of the pandemic and et cetera, right?
Right.
So similar move in 2008. So they completely pull out and like they leave everybody at this team hanging. Like all of the employees, the drivers, everybody. And they're just like, bye, good luck.
Right.
LOL. See ya.
Classic Honda. Anyway, Ross Braun swoops in, buys the team.
Of course.
It's a very short-term solution, right?
It worked.
They did okay. They ended up with 8 victories and 15 podiums. They won a constructors championship.
They did
a driver's championship.
They had 1 year in the sport and they took the drivers and the constructors title.
Fair.
Starting from scratch, basically.
You're right.
They did very well.
Okay. Anyways.
You're just downplaying it.
I am.
You're like, this is nothing compared to what they became.
Exactly. Anyways, Mercedes then decides, of course, to buy it. But before that, while it was still Ross Braun Racing, they were supplying their engines.
Right.
So basically, Mercedes was kind of already closing in on the situation.
Yeah. Ross Braun was like a band-aid on something
it kind
that
of
needed
was.
Stitches.
It was like, it was like an emergency solution to Honda.
Yeah.
Being like, bye, just, I gotta go, man.
Exactly. And he, I mean, the man did it and like completely like ruined everybody's lives. But he was like,
yeah,
if I wanted to, I could rule this sport, but I won't. So I'll step back after this year. It was like kind of the vibe.
But it was really funny, like, you know, just to leave after one season like that. And especially, I mean, you're right. Like,
leave them high and dry. Also, Ross Braun was probably like, I don't want to commit this much of my own money anymore.
It's a lot. Yeah. It is a ton.
Especially with uncertainty towards engines, as we've seen in the history of the sport, right?
Exactly. So eventually, it was purchased by investors that was then rebranded as Mercedes GP for 2010.
Mm-hmm.
They did. Oh god, yeah. So they still remain in some sort of like connections to the Ross Braun team. So there wasn't like a huge total. We're changing everything. Like they didn't strip down the team too much.
No,
which was very nice.
I think that was key to where they came, right?
Yeah, and they kept the headquarters in Berkeley. Like, overall, it seemed pretty.
Just like a rebrand.
Yeah, like it seemed, it didn't seem like there was many people.
Just
that
an
were
aesthetic
upset.
Change.
Like
you
it
know?
Was, there was more like
a coat of paint.
Seems like there was a good transition. No one felt harmed or anything like that.
No.
So that was very good. So Mercedes, like, it's interesting now after we've been talking about Ferrari.
Maybe Jenson Button and felt harmed.
Probably.
Rubens Barrichello.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But anyway.
But yeah, no, but it was, I think it's nice that, I don't know if it's nice. That's not the right word. It's interesting though to have like a newer team. But also, like, Mercedes is so confusing because they also made the first car. Well, they made the first horseless carriage, right? Back in the day.
Yeah.
So
what a flex.
It is, and now it's like, I'm the best F1 team, I did it. So, they've had quite a journey through motorsport. It's just been very, very odd.
Definitely.
Anyways, we have Mercedes.
Yes. Oh, sorry, you're not finished. Keep going.
Oh, no, I wasn't, sorry.
Go ahead.
No, it's okay. No, but Mercedes... help me. Petronas. Oh, I said it right.
Petronas. You're learning.
Oh, I was gonna say Petronas, and then
no,
I was like,
no, that's what I would go to say that too. But I've seen so many commercials of Lewis at the Petronas headquarters that it's ingrained in me now to say Petronas.
Petronas. Yeah, and Lewis's voice. Mm. I can hear that. So yeah, I mean Mercedes kind of it is kind of very similar to what it is now. They didn't make a lot of changes. They just kind of grew.
They've
and
had
incredibly
like
successful.
The best
in like a
tech department. Huge names that were historically very successful.
Right.
And they had Niki Lauda as an advisor.
They do. And here's some fun percentages for you.
Go ahead.
Just because I have
I love
them.
A good percentage.
Yeah, no, I do. Constructors Championships winning percentage 66.7.
2 out of 3. Right? 2 out of 3 Constructors Championships I've ever attempted, they've won.
Pretty much. Drivers Championships 64.3%.
Almost the same. Very good.
Yeah. And winning percentage 49%.
Wow. That's one. They either win or they don't win. One or two, half and half. That's very impressive.
That's like half.
Bragging. They're like our win rate 50%.
It is. It absolutely is.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's a wild, wild, wild ride for Mercedes
for sure.
And they came back in 2010 and. They're here.
They were like, we're
doing
here.
Great.
We're going to do it. Get out of our way because we're going to win anyway. So,
yes, they are. Yes, they are.
Yeah. Apart from 2013, not a great season for them, you know. 2014 onwards was where like they really had their dominance kick in.
Yeah. Oh, I did forget to mention one thing about their history is that they had a brief stint. For 2 years as not Mercedes, but they were Benz AG. They were Daimler Benz AG.
Daimler.
That's what I said.
That's the parent company of Mercedes.
Yeah.
Like they own a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that didn't really last. No. And they
it's not as cool
really
as
finish.
Mercedes, is it? Mercedes AMG Petronas F1G. Like that sounds like
exactly
like a cool name.
Yeah, but I think the important note of that's kind of the only important note of that is that Juan Manuel Fangio also drove for.
That's right. Is he the guy behind you in the picture?
No, this is Ferrari.
Does that say 16? Does that say 16?
I believe that
Charles
it does.
Charles Leclerc, is that you?
Yes.
Is that you? No, but because I asked because there's Sky did a piece where Lewis drove Fangio's old Mercedes car. At Monza, I believe, on the old Monza circuit.
Yeah.
Which was very cool.
Very cool.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Now it's not looking so good for them these days. For the first time in ever, really.
Not so good.
Yeah.
No.
Which is a bit of a shock to the system, I'm sure, for that team. Yeah. You know, the no side pods thing, not a good move, it turns out.
Yeah, not so great. Not so great.
Right. So let me do Alpine first because it's my last old school team, and then I can do Red Bull, then you can do Toro, or you can do Toro and then I can do Red Bull since Toro existed first, if you want.
You do Red Bull and then I'll do Toro.
Okay. So Alpine has been a number of different teams. It started as a small outlet in 1981 called Tolman. They, like, most of the time even struggled to make the starting grid during their first few seasons. Like, they, like, didn't even really qualify for races. But they kept going, which is good for them. And it's good for them that they did, because Ayrton Senna arrived at that team in 1984
and put them on the map. So they waited out. Yeah, they held out and it worked out because they ended up with 3 podium finishes that year, thanks to him. But then 85, they like missed the first 3 races of the season because they had a dispute with Pirelli, who was their tire supplier at the time. So Pirelli, you know, just has a lot of disputes, you know, still to this day. So at that point in 1985, they debuted with a United Colors of Benetton livery in Monaco. And United Colors of Benetton is an Italian clothing company that's pretty famous. If you guys are interested, there's a lot of old United Colors of Benetton F1 merch on Etsy, if you're interested. So by the end of that season, that clothing company took over the team and it became Benetton. In sort of like 1986 to 2001/2002-ish. So they were immediately on the pace as Benetton. They had a BMW engine, which helped secure their debut win as a team in Mexico. Mm-hmm. 1986 mm-hmm. with Gerhard Berger, I never know how to say his last name.
Don't ask me.
great guy. Went on to drive for Ferrari, I believe, at some point. But they then, like a lot of other teams, switched around. They shopped about for engines. So they switched to Cosworth in 87. And then, despite having multiple fraud convictions, accusations, convictions to his name, none other than
classic
Flavio Briatore was appointed as managing director ahead of the 1990 season, which was like
classic.
Bring in the girl, like get him in. Love him. Crazy guy. Bernie hates him, but we love that relationship. Anyway, yes. So he's now like running the team. He's the hot shot. And he's also like a big, like, he's a quite an intimidating guy. And he like, I'm trying to think of like a comparison to like current F1. Like, maybe, I don't know, maybe like a Lawrence Stroll type, but with not with the billionaire money where he's like intimidating, but maybe like never mind. So anyway, like I said when I was talking about who was I talking about? Another team. Michael Schumacher, Aston Martin, I think. Yes, when it was Jordan. Michael Schumacher then did one race with them and then Benetton was like, "Hey boy, come here." And he did. So he left them after one race. And and then in 1994, he won the driver's title that year for his first. And then he won it again in 95, back-to-back. So they had a pretty successful time as a team, which was cool. Because they also had, when they secured Michael Schumacher in 1991, they also secured Mr. Ross Brawn, who you were just talking about.
That I was.
And Rory Byrne, who was like really their tech guy, and they very good team. And when Schumacher left the team to go to Ferrari in 96, he also took Brawn and Byrne with him. And that's when Ferrari started to become very dominant as well. So you can imagine that trio behind the scenes, very powerful. And then the Benetton as a team started to decline when they all left, really. And then Renault was like, hey-o, and took them over in 2000. Good year to take over a team, I feel like. New millennium, fresh start. But they decided for some reason to remain with the Benetton name. I'm sure it was contractual until 2002. So Renault always had previously competed in Formula 1 from 1977 to 1984. So as a separate team. So the current Renault Alpine team wasn't rooted in the old Renault team, so that's why it's not included really in this history. But they did compete as a separate team in the 70s and 80s, and they bowed out after financial struggles, which is a common thing that seems to happen in Formula 1. But you were talking about turbo engines with Honda. Renault pioneered the turbo technology used in F1 engines, so they were like the inventors of it.
There you go.
So there you go. So that's why they're sort of like been consistently an engine supplier. Like when I think of Renault, I don't think of engines personally. But, you know, reading all this stuff, you're like, of course, they invented turbo, duh. So.
Yeah, I mean, they were a big part of engines. I guess I just don't think of them like particularly innovative or successful.
Right. It seems that way. So they did that, but then they re-entered as an engine supplier when the turbo era ended and powered Williams to like the back-to-back success they had in the 90s that I was talking about. And they then adopted Fernando Alonso into the team, which took them to new heights in 2003 when he joined.
Yes.
And then in 2005, they also had James Allison on board, who you can talk about. Well, I was going to say you could talk about, but you just talked about Mercedes, who's currently at Mercedes, who was also a part of the Ferrari Dream Team when Schumacher went to Ferrari. Mm-hmm. So I believe he was at Ferrari and then changed to Renault after Schumacher sort of like era sort of ended. And yeah. That's when Fernando started winning, and he beat Kimi to the title in 2005, which is cool. And then they also won the constructors and then defended that in 2006, both drivers and constructors. But then Fernando mm-hmm. decided to leave them and go to McLaren.
Bad idea.
For a year. Bad. But then he came back in 2008. Because you're right, it was a bad idea. But 2008 was Crashgate for Renault, which I wanted to touch briefly. I'm not going to go into too much detail. But basically, the debut Singapore Grand Prix, Fernando was P15. And he went from P15 to winning the race. But it came out a year later, after, that he benefited from a deliberate crash by his teammate, Nelson Piquet Jr., who'd crashed deliberately right after Fernando pitted early to bring out a safety car so that Fernando could benefit all those positions. So there you go. And that handed Renault as a team a 2-year suspension from Formula One. So that's why they disappeared. So
ridiculous.
Yes, ridiculous. Right. And guess who else was banned? Flavio.
Oh, not the penalty, I mean.
No. The incident, I know.
Yes.
It is ridiculous. Yeah. But Flavio was also banned from Formula One. And Pat Simons, the tech guy, was also banned from involvement in Fire. But they were overturned like 2 years later, but I still probably would not see them involved anytime in the future. So when that happened, 2009.
Head down.
Yeah.
For sure.
2009 was miserable, obviously. And then 2010, they got Robert Kubica, who was going to be, like, their next star, right? He was so good. And he got them 2 podium finishes that year, which was, you know, sort of an unexpected thing after what had happened.
Yeah.
And then the team became Lotus in 2011 because Renault signed over... They had already sold some of their shares to this company called... This, like, consortium called Genie or Jenny Capital. Yeah. And then they sold the rest of their shares completely to that consortium, so they no longer owned any of the teams, so it became solely Lotus. But what was funny about that was that there was already another team on the grid named Lotus, so there was 2 teams named Lotus in 2011.
Of course.
And then there ended up being a court hearing, and then Lotus, that I'm talking about currently, the Lotus Renault team, won that, so they got to stay as Lotus. But then something horrible happened. They lost Robert Kubica because he ended up in a rally crash that he sustained, you know, like life-changing injuries that would inhibit him from driving. But it was nice that he got to return in 2019 to Williams to drive alongside George. But, you know, he wasn't at his full shape, which is really sad because he could have really been really great in Formula One if he wasn't injured. But then they decided to bring Kimi back, which was like both the best thing they ever did and the worst thing they ever did because he was so good. He was so good that he put them into like administration because they had made a deal with him for every point he scored, they would give him 50,000 euros bonus. And so Kimi took 6 podiums that year, basically, and took them to P4 in the constructors. And then he ditched in 2014 to go to Ferrari, back to Ferrari. And so he left with a 20 million euro bonus from all the points he scored for Lotus and basically bankrupted them, essentially.
Which makes sense.
Because I don't think he ever ended up getting that money because they just didn't have it. And he had to, like, sue them for the money because they promised him the money. And so they sold the team back to Renault at the end of 2015 when Kimi left, basically. So that was a thing. So it became Renault again.
Yeah.
2016. And this is where we enter Cyril Abiteboul. The man, the myth, the legend. We love him. I wish he was back. I really want him back. Like, I love Otmar, great guy, but he's so, like, boring. Like, bring back Cyril, please.
I know, I miss Cyril.
I want Cyril to go to Aston Martin and, like, really give Lawrence a piece of his mind, you know? That'd be great.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this is where Cyril gets involved, and we love Cyril. Look up videos of him if you guys are unfamiliar with him. and then they bring in Nico Hülkenberg, who has one of like the saddest racing records ever, right? Because he's never podiumed or won a race, but he won GP2 and he came into F1 looking so successful, and it was like, but he was a consistent point scorer, so it was good for them. And they also brought Carlos Sainz in on loan from the Red Bull team at this point, which brought them up to P4 in the constructors, so it was a good year for them. But then Carlos left to McLaren, another driver going to McLaren. We love to see it. And in came Daniel Ricciardo, hot off the Red Bull train, which was something I'll talk about when I talk about Red Bull. And like, he got them a couple of podiums and it was sort of good for them and they were moving up. But then like, Cyril got like kicked out, basically. They were like, we moved down one spot on the constructors and we need to blame somebody for it. So we blame Cyril. He got scapegoated. I like to say he got scapegoated. I don't know.
I think so. I don't know.
Like, we don't know the internals, but it definitely feels like he got scapegoated.
It does feel like that. It does.
And so he left, and then Daniel left as well for McLaren. Yeah,
it's rough for them.
It was rough for them because like, it was all like, Daniel's our future, blah, blah, blah. But they still had Esteban Ocon at this point, and he's a good person to put your future on, I think.
Yeah.
So instead of looking to the future, they looked to the past and they brought back Fernando Alonso, their 2-time world champion, and changed their name for a fresh start to Alpine, which was sort of, it's like Renault sports car division, basically.
Yeah. So it kind of makes sense. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know.
I think it makes sense. And I mean,
yeah.
Alpine, like, it sounds cool. But I miss the yellow on the car, I do.
Yeah.
I like
too many blue cars on the grid, I think.
I like the blue and the pink, but I miss the yellow.
Yeah.
And the yellow and black was such a strong statement, too. So I wish they could have brought that back.
Do yellow and pink, that'd be fun.
That'd be cool. Hell yeah. Anyway. So that's really it for Alpine. So I'll quickly do Red Bull, because it's not got as long a history, and then you can jump and do Toro Rosso, and then I'll finish off with the baby of all babies, Haas.
Yeah. All right.
So Red Bull started really before a team, being a team as a sponsor for Sauber, who are currently Alfa Romeo Sauber, which you talked about. They were a very sizable sponsor. They were like the title sponsor for Sauber. Until Kimi Raikkonen came along, which we talked about in our helmet highlight for Kimi Raikkonen. So yeah. Basically, Red Bull's Driver Academy had a deal with Sauber. They were like, take our guy because we're your sponsor. And they were like, no, we'll take Kimi instead. And so Red Bull were like, okay, well, you've really angered us, so you're no longer getting our money. And so this is where the journey to become their own team starts. So rewind a little bit. 1987 is where the foundations of this team start, with Stewart Grand Prix, which is the team of Sir Jackie Stewart, Formula One world champion. Again, another driver forming his own team. So he announced plans in 1996 with his son Paul to enter their own team for the next season. And prior to entering F1, like Jordan, they were also successful in like British Formula 3 and Formula 3000, which is today's F3 equivalent. And so they entered Formula One competing with Ford as their engine provider, which I feel like is a very like common pattern we see teams entering with Ford. It's like the basic before you can upgrade, you know.
the starter pack, right.
And they founded the Milton Keynes headquarters that Red Bull operates out of today, much to Yuki Tsunoda's dismay. He hates Milton Keynes with a passion. He hates the food, he hates the weather, he hates everything.
I would feel that way if I was from Japan. I would be like,
Milton Keynes is a bit of like a legend in the UK for being like one of the worst places to live, so people from Milton Keynes hate Milton Keynes, so it's okay, we understand, Yuki, don't worry.
There you go.
So that's the same factory they use now, where they now have a building named after Sebastian Vettel, which I think is very cool. Because obviously, for reasons I'll get into in a second, he's a big part of Red Bull's history. So they struggled with reliability issues as Stewart Grand Prix for a bit. Mm-hmm. Rubens Barrichello, who also is a driver that seems to be everywhere, all over the place.
Yes, absolutely.
He really shopped around. For him. He had the most race starts out of any driver until last year, where Kimi Raikkonen overtook him. So he was a well-seasoned driver. He took them to their only points finish ever in Monaco, where he finished P2. And then they continued to struggle following regulation changes. And then Ford tried to invest more to help them. And then Johnny Herbert joined the team and gave them their first race win and only race win at the Nürburgring, which is a great circuit to do it at. And they finished P4 that year. But then Ford were like, so we're just going to buy you outright. And so they did. And so they bought the team and decided they wanted this. They had this idea that they were going to create the British Ferrari, essentially. So they were like, what's a good British car brand that we're like in with? Jaguar. So, which is, I could see that becoming like the British Ferrari in a way,
I guess.
So I feel like Aston Martin's like a stronger pull. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
But Jaguar also, the history. Jaguar also kind of cool. So, which is a Formula E team these days. So, yeah, so there you go. So they took Jaguar and they wanted to, it was like a spearhead for Ford's like campaign to promote the Jaguar brand to a global scale, basically. So it was basically an advertising thing. It was basically Ford Racing labeled as Jaguar Racing.
Yeah.
And they got Eddie Irvine in as a driver, who's a very well decorated driver. Who had finished P2 in the Drivers' Championship the year before with Ferrari, and he teamed up with Johnny Herbert. So we love Johnny Herbert. We do. But 2000 was Johnny's final year, so he left without scoring a point, which was due to the car's performance, really. And 2001 was pretty miserable. And then Ford got frustrated, and they were like, where's the return of investment, guys? Like, this is not it for us. So 2003, it got a little bit better because of a new recruit called Mark Webber, who, very great driver, stuck with the team. He was like a good foundation for Red Bull, I think, because 2004, Ford had no hope left in the world for anything. So they were like, peace out. And so in came the sale to Red Bull. And so we see Red Bull Racing enter in 2005, and they retain Mark Webber, which is a smart choice. So he stays, and they also bring in David Coulthard as well, who you spoke about previously. Great couple of drivers. I think that was a strong lineup to start with as a new team. And so since entering as a team, Red Bull, like, their achievements have only ever been eclipsed by Mercedes. So they're like the second most successful team currently on the grid. And they're they're still kind of young, actually. They're like a baby team. So they have four drivers' championships. Or sorry, how dare I? Five drivers' championships. I genuinely didn't mean to say that. Four and a half.
Awkward.
So they have five drivers' championships. Four of them come from Sebastian Vettel.
Yes.
Who you're probably going to talk about in a second as well, for reasons at Toro Rosso. But he started at Toro Rosso before he came to Red Bull.
Yeah.
So you'll probably mention that. So he brought them four drivers' championships, and with Mark Webber, brought four constructors back to back from 2010 to 2013. They were like dominating that entire era, and then the regulations changed in 2014, and it was like, no! And that's when Mercedes came in and like kicked butt. So Max Verstappen brought them their most recent drivers' championship, which a lot of people will disagree with. A lot of people think, yes, he did, but that's up for debate still, funnily enough. So in total, they have 77 wins, 75 poles, and 210 podiums to this day, which very impressive, you know?
Yeah, not bad.
For a relatively young team, I mean, this 2005, they're like, what, like 18 or something? Now, 17, 18, so like they're just getting out of high school, you know, and they're already very successful, so good for them. And Christian Horner has like been with them since the beginning. Like, he was the youngest ever team principal, which, you know, you have to like give him some props. Like, as much as he's like so unlikable in certain aspects, he did the job. He did it well. He's still clearly doing it well. But also like not well in other aspects. But in our opinion, we don't know. He might be the nicest man on the planet if you talk to him in person. But he just comes across as very like abrasive. But anyway, so that's Red Bull. Very short and sweet history. Cool history.
All right. Good history.
Go on then.
Let me jump into Toro Rosso AlphaTauri right now. Quickly, because I know this episode is
getting longer.
Long.
It's like our team principals episode, though. We went a little bit longer, but that's okay. Because we can timestamp it and give people links to whatever they want to listen to.
So, as we know, Toro Rosso associated with Red Bull. Originally not Toro Rosso. So before that, it was actually Minardi, which I'm sure that you know the name if you know motorsport, because they were not just in F1, but they were in other and are in other different parts of the sport. So absolutely a well-known name and successful in other places, but not successful in Formula One. did not win anything ever. They never got a podium.
Mm-mm.
Never got a pole position. Their best finish was fourth, and their constructors' championship was seventh. So, rough time. Rough time
rough
for them.
Time.
Very rough time for them. Anyways, later on, it became Toro Rosso because it was failing. Fun fact, Jos Verstappen actually was one of the racers.
That's
for
right.
Minardi.
That's right.
So, yeah, wild, wild times for that.
Again, incestuous.
The most bizarre sort of
word of
family
the day.
Tree that all of
incestuous.
These.
Incestuous.
Truly. So, anyys, we have Scuderia, there we go. Toro Rosso, which we all know, I'm sure, if you've been around Formula One besides the last 2 years, you know, well,
yes.
Toro Rosso. Like you said, that's where a lot of drivers have gotten their start.
Mm-hmm.
Sebastian Vettel, Carlos Sainz, Max Verstappen,
Daniel Ricciardo, Pierre Gasly. Yeah.
To name
a few.
Just name a few.
Yeah.
And originally, it was associated with Ferrari, actually, because they had Ferrari engines. So I guess do with that what you will, if that's a Ferrari general association or not.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Italian teams. I feel like they're always like, please, Ferrari, please come.
Yeah.
We're family.
Help me. So anyways, there was a guy named Paul Stoddart.
Yes.
If I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yes, you are.
Who sold his remaining interest in the Minardi team.
Australian, I believe. I think he is.
Another fellow named
Dietrich
Mateschitz.
Yes.
Mateschitz, yeah.
Red Bull's CEO, basically. The drinks company.
Yeah, the owner. The major main owner
of... The big
of
brand.
The big man.
By the way, that guy is like a branding genius. Like, huge genius for marketing and branding.
Yeah. So Toro Rosso actually means, you guessed it, Red Bull in Italian. Crazy. It used Ferrari engines up to 2013, and then eventually they switched to Renault, just like Red Bull.
Mm-hmm. They basically
they sort of conjoined
the Red Bull team, right, in terms of engine.
Yeah. They just really became
the B team
of Red Bull, like, immediately. Like, they entered into the sport sort of chiefly...
Hey, they're not a B team.
As that.
They're a sister team.
Okay, now they're a
Christian
sister team.
Christian Horner says so himself.
When they were Toro Rosso, I think that they were the B team. AlphaTauri, I think maybe it's a little bit
when
different.
When Pierre Gasly won in Monza, that's when Christian Horner was like, oh, God. Now I have to say that they're not the B team.
Right?
I don't want to embarrass us.
I know. Anyways, that's like the biggest part of Toro Rosso. Those are the main highlights, really. Yeah.
Well, Toro Rosso existed before Red Bull, right? As a team?
Under a different... What year was...
Red Bull was 2005. As a team.
Well, as a actual Toro Rosso, they were in 2006.
Oh, okay.
It was their first Grand Prix that they entered.
Ooh, you know what it is? They won a race before Red Bull.
Yeah, they won a race.
Seb
won a first race with them. 2008,
I remember it well. It's like one of the things that I just like know off the top of my head because I'm a Seb fan. But like he won their first race and beat Red Bull to winning a race. And it was a wet race as well. And like nobody expected this kid, 21-year-old kid, to like take the win in a Toro Rosso, and he did it, and it was like the moment his life changed, basically. So
exactly.
There you go.
Anyways. Nothing really changed when the name changed, frankly.
No.
It was solely to promote AlphaTauri, which is a fashion brand.
I don't know if it's working, to be honest.
I mean, I think it's cool. Like, Yuki looks cool.
Yeah.
Pierre, like, looks cool, but he always wears turtlenecks.
Pierre looks cool, but he looks like somebody else is dressing him. Yuki looks like he's choosing to dress like that himself, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
But, I agree. I mean, the whole Red Bull and Toro Rosso teams, as they are, exist as marketing exercises for the energy drinks company anyway. So,
yeah,
100%. Like, Red Bull's like that throughout sports anyway. Like, if you look at most sports, you will see Red Bull-sponsored athletes all over the place.
100%.
So yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to say when I was saying that Dietrich is a marketing genius, because he really is a marketing genius to put an unhealthy beverage like an energy drink on sports marketing and make it seem like totally okay and normal.
Yeah,
but yeah, Red Bull, like, they never change their livery either, because it's like the best advertising for their energy
drink. It's true,
and I guess it works. So
yeah,
that's,
I guess,
AlphaTauri. I don't know yet, we'll have to see.
Yeah, I mean, they did make a big improvement in the last 2 years since they became AlphaTauri.
That's true.
I mean, it's not due to like any engine changes or anything that we can see like that.
Yeah,
I think overall it's just better.
I mean, work on France the car Tost, and the man, he does it.
I mean, he is the man. I think absolutely
he is the man.
So anyways, you know what? Let's hear about Haas.
I was going to say, you know what else might have helped? Is having a consistent driver lineup.
That could help.
But anyway, yeah, let's hear about Haas, who's the newborn infant of the Formula One grid as we speak.
That it is.
Which I didn't realize that Haas was a completely new, like, factory team. I thought they had bought out another, like, taken over another factory and just rebranded as Haas, which would make sense. And they kind of did a tiny bit, but not really. So Haas came into the sport in 2016. They initially wanted to come in 2015. So this is how young they are. 2016 was their first year in the sport. NASCAR team owner Gene Haas, who's a big name in the motorsport industry, very rich guy, was like, hey, I want to try another kind of motorsport. And Gunter Steiner, this guy, this Italian guy who sounds German but is actually Italian, is like bugging me to enter Formula One. So, you know, I might as well do it. That's really kind of the story of what happened, was that Gunter went over to America and ended up working in, I think it was IndyCar, because he used to work for Red Bull and Ferrari. And then he was like the tech chief at Red Bull or something, I think. Something crazy like that. Anyway.
I think that's hilarious.
I know, right? Like, very good.
Gunter at Red Bull.
And then he was like, I have bigger things in my head. And he was like, Gene, please, I will be the team principal, I promise. And so Gene was like, okay, funny man, I'll give you a Formula One team. So he funded a Formula One team for Gunter Steiner, which, Gene Haas, that's the best thing you've ever done, I promise. Because Gunter is like the best thing ever. So happy that this has happened. So anyway, the team is headquartered in Kannapolis. I thought it was Annapolis. Turns out Kannapolis, North Carolina, which is near Charlotte. And it's the first American constructor to submit a Formula One entry after the failed US F1 project in 2010. There was a whole movement to try and get Formula One to America, and it didn't work. But now, here, three races in America, we're doing things. It's owned by an American company. There you go.
I don't know if it'll work, though.
We'll see. I feel like Vegas is going to be a huge deal. Miami, I'm so questionable about. We'll find out this weekend.
I think Miami is so stupid because I low-key think that the tickets are so expensive because it took so much money to build
the fake marina.
That track. Yeah, the fake marina. Well, what the heck?
The original circuit they wanted to do was along the marina, but then the city refused to allow it. So they built a fake one instead, basically.
Sad. You don't need a fake one, like. Anyways, I'm sorry.
No, we can talk about this when we're talking about the race on next episode. But yeah, so they were the first American constructor since the 80s, which the last American constructor was also, funnily enough, called Haas, but unrelated. Just Haas Lola, but an unrelated Haas. Completely different, you know?
Bizarre.
Very bizarre. Like two Lotuses, two Haases. There you go. So basically what they did in a way to kind of take over a factory team was Marussia, the F1 team collapsed, basically. And Haas were like, we'll buy your headquarters in England because we kind of need a European base and we don't have a factory. So so that's kind of how they took over another team. But they didn't buy that team. They just bought the headquarters, basically.
Yeah.
And use it. In Banbury. Fun place.
Just kind of fun that we have a new team that didn't buy out another team. You know what I mean?
Well, this is another thing too, is that they got like Dallara to build their chassis and Ferrari to supply their engine. And they have like a special relationship with Ferrari, which they were applauded for. This is why Haas is special, because they were applauded for pioneering like a new low-cost model that would allow other new teams to enter the sport and be competitive immediately, right?
Yeah.
Which was controversial because privateer teams like Williams and stuff were like, hey, we have to invest in our own infrastructure. Why don't they have to invest in theirs? It's not fair.
For sure.
And like they were also expressing concern over like Haas's relationship to Ferrari. They were like, what's the deal here? We sharing secrets? We sharing blueprints? What's going on? And so that all came to like a head really in 2018 when Haas showed up to testing with a car that pretty much resembled Ferrari's 2017 car. Kind of like how Racing Point copied Mercedes' 2019 car. Haas did it first. Yeah.
Trendsetter.
Yeah, trendsetter. I mean, they are really, to be honest. So they were criticized for that. And then there was a rule discussion in 2021. Where McLaren and Renault were like, we don't like this. We really don't like the relationship. This is not on. But then Ross Brawn was like, I don't care if you don't like it. I'm protecting this model for future teams to enter with smaller budgets, because that's really what we've been struggling is getting new manufacturers into the sport. So there you go. So that's something that they were very like proud of pioneering, but also everyone was like, ugh. So it's still kind of controversial. Yeah. But anyway, so 2016... Grosjean got their first points in their debut race, which, like, that never happens because they're the second team to ever score points in their debut race, which I think is an impressive feat. Like, Haas gets a lot of flack, but they came out of the gate, like, sprinting, really. Yeah. And they finished P8 in the constructors, which is respectable for a new team, I think.
Yeah, for first year,
And they finished P8 again the next year. And then 2018, when they copied the Ferrari, they had like a really amazing start, it seemed like, in Australia. This is the first season of Drive to Survive, if you guys remember, the very first episode. They were running P4 and P5 in the race, and then both retired because they both had really bad pit stops where the wheels ended up falling off, basically.
Yeah.
And Gunter was like, we're a bunch of... I won't say it because we're a clean podcast here, but you know.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, Gene Haas put so much of his own money and this is embarrassing and we're a clown show and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you know, classic Gunter. So that's classic. That. 2019 is where it really kicks off for the clown show. this is where Rich Energy enters into the scene.
Oh my goodness, Rich Energy.
Rich Energy, baby! And they were the title sponsor of Haas, basically. They were. And so in July of that year, the Rich Energy, this is where the controversy and like the jokes all occur. Rich Energy's yes. official Twitter account announced that the sponsorship deal was terminated in July. Just out of the blue, no like discussion of it. They were like, it's ending. But then that was denied immediately by like the shareholders of Rich Energy. And they were like, it was a rogue agent. We don't know who did that. Which is hilarious. Like everyone was like, huh? What? And then Rich Energy faced like a number of legal issues, like for like copyright infringement, for stealing a logo of another company and all that sort of stuff. And their owner is like an insane man. If you've never seen him, he's insane. William Story, I believe his name is. And so in September of that year, they pulled out after the Italian Grand Prix, basically, mm-hmm. and then announced the termination of their sponsorship deal. So Haas was left like penniless almost. They really got like the short end of this. What's the short end of the stick? Is that a saying? Is that like two sayings put together? You know what I mean.
Short end of the stick. There you go. That's correct.
They pulled the short straw. There you go.
Either.
Whatever. Mixing metaphors. And then 2020 was a horrible year for Haas, actually, because that was the year that Grosjean had his horrific crash in Bahrain, where he exploded into flames and got stuck in his car, and the car split in half, and it was a horrible. But he, like, by some miracle of some kind, survived with just badly burned hands, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, tech put into keeping the driver safe, and we've discussed this 100 times on our podcast. The halo, the helmets, the fireproofing, everything. Like, so that really was like a signature for Haas in that season, and it sort of ended that sort of era of like horrificness for them. And so they wanted a clean start, and they also needed money. And so they decided to say goodbye to both of their drivers who they'd had throughout their entire existence as a team, Kevin Magnussen and Romain Grosjean, and bring in two rookies, which could be seen as like a huge mistake by any team, right? Like, you always kind of want someone with experience to give you like feedback on the car, right? But they're bringing in two rookies, and they decided it was a development year because they were like, we're not going to spend any money developing our car because it's going to be, we just know we're not going to be good because we didn't have the money to develop it anyway. So we're going to put all of the money we get this year into our car for next year. So they brought in Nikita Mazepin from Russia and his father's company, Ural Kali, which is like a petrochemical fertilizer or something or other, where he was basically an oligarch in Russia, and they're like close friends and allies of Putin. And so that sort of kicked off a whole thing, because the Haas livery was like, it looked like a Russian flag, and it was sort of been like, are you like breaking the rules? Because the World Drug Association were like, you can't have Russian athletes or Russian flags or anything in sport. And that was a whole thing. And then Russia decided to declare war on Ukraine, which then Haas took the moral high ground and also probably the smart business venture and kicked Mazepin out of the team. And took their association with Ural Kali away and got a completely new driver. But they also had, I forgot to mention, Mick Schumacher. He was he's been there this whole time. Son of Michael Schumacher, Formula 2 world champion. Great guy. Very sweet guy. Yeah. Like, probably one of the nicest people ever in the Formula 1 history. It seems like, anyway. I don't know him personally, but it seems like it.
Yeah.
and so in 2022, they brought back none other than Kevin Magnussen, which I think has been a very good move for them so far.
I think so, too.
I have to say. And all that money they used from the Mazepin bank account to develop their 2022 car has paid off for them. It really worked out.
No, for real.
Because
for real.
This has to be one of their most successful seasons since 2018, I have to say. So
I hope, I think so too.
After all the stuff they've been through with Rich Energy and with Mazepin and with Bahrain and all of this stuff, that they finally come out on top for once. And it seems like they are. Yeah. They're definitely competing further up the grid than they normally do. So
100%.
And they still are a baby team, let's be honest. They are. Some teams
are
start off well and then take like this many years on like the downswing and then come back. But Haas are still a baby, so they've got time to really figure themselves out.
Right.
Hopefully with some more money actually at some point.
Yeah.
And I think they will get it now that they've got, you know, Mick
some points.
Mick. And they're scoring points, right? And Kevin's probably bringing in some Danish stuff. I know he brought in like Danish clothing company sponsorship to the old Haas, so I don't know if they'll come back. But yeah, so that's
probably
all of the teams. That was a lot. This has been a long episode. It was a lot. Cool information. I mean, interesting.
Very.
Learned some new things today from you. Learned lots of patterns that repeat throughout Formula One history in terms of ups and downs, engines, drivers. Mm-hmm. Everyone's driven for McLaren.
Yeah, basically.
There's always a tragedy somewhere, and there's always some insane dominant performance somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
It's an incestuous sport.
It is.
And that's the message of today's lesson.
Yes. There's a lot of family trees here.
A lot of, like, intertwining branches.
Yes. And then there's Haas.
And then there's Haas. They're, like, kicking it by themselves. But potentially making it with Ferrari behind the bleachers and just not telling anybody, you know? So...
Okay. Oh, my gosh.
Right.
Alrighty.
Well,
thank you for listening.
If you're still here.
if you're still here. All right.
Thanks for listening, like you said, if you are listening still. See you in Miami, guys. Reach out to us. I was about to forget to do this again. We're on social media at SpeedTrapPod, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and we have an email address, speedtrappod@gmail.com, for longer inquiries.
Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to donate, you can head to anchor.fm/speed-trap-pod and hit the donate button. We would really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Speed Trap Podcast.
As always, we appreciate your support.
To stay involved in the conversation, reach out to us on social media at Speed Trap Pod.
Speed Trap's official music was created and produced by Boxed Okami. You can find more of his work on Instagram at Boxed Okami.
See you next week.